It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Obama has embarked on a 3-day official visit to former foe Vietnam, part of his rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region, and has both countries move toward closer security and economic links. Carl Thayer, professor emeritus at Australia's University of New South Wales, says Vietnam has been a success story of Mr. Obama's rebalance.
They signed on to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, early. They will ratify it in June at the National Assembly meeting. And then security ties are also on the agenda, and the rebalance was in part about reassuring the region that the United States would stay engaged in the South China Sea dispute. Is center stage.
The visit comes as both Vietnam and the U.S. show growing concern over China's territorial ambitions in the South China Sea. Among the issues expected to be raised during the 3-day visit, the future of a U.S. arms embargo on Vietnam, a vestige of the Vietnam War that ended 4 decades ago. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has announced the start of a military offensive to retake the city of Fallujah, held by the Islamic State for more than 2 years. Mr. Abadi said the offensive will be conducted by the army in coordination with police, counterterrorism forces, local Sunni tribesmen, and elements of Shia militia. Meanwhile, Baghdad remains tense after anti-government protesters were driven from the heavily fortified Green Zone, where government offices are located, by security forces using live ammunition and tear gas. The mostly Shia demonstrators are demanding reform. Nigerian union members Sunday called off a national strike over a spike in fuel prices, saying they'll resume talks with the government. Members of the Nigerian Labor Congress walked out of negotiations last week, ordering the strike despite a court injunction. The cutback in popular fuel subsidy was ordered because of a lack of foreign exchange for fuel importers to pay for supplies. This is VOA News. The Afghan intelligence agency confirmed that Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansour was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Pakistan near the Afghan border. Taliban officials privately confirmed the death of their leader, but added any final determination will be made by the group's leadership council. RAND Corporation analyst Jonah Blank called the apparent death of Mansour an intelligence coup.
It still is completely unreported exactly how this came about and what it was that led to the targeting. Was this information that the United States had for quite a while but had decided not to act on in the hopes that Mullah Mansour might come and bring the Taliban to the negotiating table? Or was this simply a fast-breaking piece of intelligence that had to be acted on or else the opportunity would go? At this point, we don't know.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Mansour was targeted because he posed an imminent threat to U.S. personnel, Afghan civilians, and Afghan security forces, and that he was directly opposed to peace negotiations. Secretary Kerry was hailing Myanmar's transition to democracy Sunday, but urged its new civil-led government to continue its work on implementing key reforms meant to improve development and human rights.
The key to the lifting of the sanctions is really the progress that is made within Myanmar in continuing to move down the road of democratization. We strongly support the democratic transition that is taking place here.
Kerry's visit came days after Washington lifted various financial and trade sanctions imposed on Myanmar, also known as Burma, when it was under military rule. Bans on scores of other individuals and groups remain in place. Vote counting in Austria's presidential election shows rightist candidate Norbert Hofer and independent Alexander Van der Bellen in a statistical dead heat, leaving a winner to be determined Monday after nearly 90,000 absentee ballots are counted. Greek lawmakers Sunday approved fresh spending cuts and tax hikes demanded by European creditors in exchange for a new installment of desperately needed bailout funds. The legislation, which also provides a mechanism to slash spending in future cases, budget overruns, comes 2 days ahead of a key meeting of Eurozone finance ministers set to assess Athens' compliance with bailout terms of last year. Turkey's ruling party has chosen Binali Yildirim as ally of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan as leader and presumptive prime minister. Yildirim is the transport minister and a founding member of the Justice and Development Party. The UN says Sudanese authorities have declined to renew a permit for the head of its humanitarian coordination office in Khartoum. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Monday, May 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Labour Congress suspends its week-long strike over fuel price increases.
We have called off the strike and the national protest arising from the intervention of some well-meaning Nigerians. First, the National Assembly, the Senate and the House of Representatives, but also the leader of the ruling All Progressive Congress.
Ayuba Wabba is president of the Nigeria Labour Congress. Somalia's president issues a decree to legalize the country's 2016 electoral process. Cameroonian youth receive livestock as an incentive not to join Boko Haram. And a Burundian civil society leader expressed very little progress at the ongoing Arusha peace talks.
What can they expect when the opposition is not on the board? What do they expect when armed groups are not on the board? What do they expect when civil society are not on the board?
Vital Nshimirimana is the president of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society in Burundi. World leaders meet today in Istanbul, Turkey, to find solutions to global humanitarian crises. And the presence of Zika virus is confirmed in Cape Verde. Those stories plus Marco Uma Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Nigeria Labour Congress has called off the nearly week-long strike over an increase in fuel prices and electricity taxes. The union went on strike last week after the government raised the price of a gallon of gasoline from 86.5 naira or 43 cents to 145 naira or 73 cents per gallon. The union said their members would not return to work unless the government rescinded the increase. The government said it recommended the increases to end shortages caused by a foreign exchange crisis. Ayuba Wabba, president of the Nigeria Labour Congress, says the decision to suspend the strike was made Sunday by the union's National Executive Council following the intervention of what he called some well-meaning Nigerians.
We have called off the strike and the national protest arising from the intervention of some well-meaning Nigerians. First, the National Assembly, the Senate and the House of Representatives, but also the leader of the ruling All Progressive Congress, whom, as we are aware, led a very powerful delegation to the Secretariat of the Nigerian Labour Congress located in Abuja on Friday. And we had some engagements, and they have pleaded that let us call off the action and allow for negotiation and a peaceful process of resolution be put in place.
You want to strike because of the hike in the fuel prices. When you go back to negotiate, is your point of negotiation going to be different, or are you going to negotiate on the same issues?
Well, we went on the strike and protest action on two issues. One, the hike in electricity tariff by almost 65%. And the second issue of the hike in the pump price of PMS with almost also 67.6%. When you look at the two issues, the expenditure have actually gone up, but I think the purchasing power of ordinary workers have remained very static, and therefore is something that is not affordable. So as we approach the negotiation table, is to look at how best we can be able to get these issues resolved, especially the purchasing power of ordinary workers.
Mr. Wabba, are you calling off the strike because it did not have an impact, or you're calling off because it's a renegotiation?
Is that, you know, that when we call strikes, is to create a platform for people to engage the policy. We have created that platform. We have done street protests, and the argument has been well captured and advanced. That's the essence of our action. Because once policies are not good, we have a right as citizens to protest those policies. And that's what essentially NLC have done consistently. But don't also forget that NLC have, from time immemorial, had a very robust discussion on some of these issues, and we have had positions that have actually assisted in discussing these issues. So first, it's not even about the price issue. It's about, first, whether it's affordable or not, and whether this policy option of over-relying on importation instead of fixing our refineries to produce for local consumption is the best option. Because the only reason given for this increase is, one, the exchange rate differential, and two, is also the price of crude oil at international markets. So if we are going to rely on these two variables to determine the price for local consumption, it's then very clear that just very short from now, this same issue will be on the table. So we thought that we should also canvass for policy option, and that is what we are going to bring to the table to look at how other policy options, like the issue of refining and the issue of getting our refineries back on stream, can then assist in addressing this issue on a long run.
Ayuba Wabba is the president of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He was speaking with me from Abuja. Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed issued a decree on Sunday legalizing the country's 2016 electoral process after the parliament failed to endorse the election rules, despite warnings from the international community that a failure to act quickly would jeopardize the political process and set the country several years back. UN envoy to Somalia Michael Keaton says the presidential decree means the electoral process will now take place on time.
My first reaction is relief that the decree means that the electoral process will take place roughly on time. Obviously, the challenge now is to get the practical steps in place so that the electoral model can be conducted by August, and that's pretty tough because it's only 90 days away. I sat in the parliament for 4.5 hours meeting the oversight committee a few days ago, and had a very good conversation with them, and I felt privileged to be greeted by them. But it was very apparent to me and all the colleagues from the international community who went to that meeting that there is no agreement within Parliament on even some of the most basic things. So it would have taken another weeks, if not months, if not years, to resolve these difficulties. And in those circumstances, it seems to me responsible and not irresponsible to issue a decree if the consequences of not holding the elections are going to be very, very negative.
Some lawmakers who spoke to VOA said the move is unconstitutional, and they said they are going to challenge it in the parliament.
Well, good for them. Let them challenge it. But I don't believe, I'm not a lawyer, I think a decree by the executive is not per se unconstitutional. But, I mean, I think they have every right to challenge it. What I think you're going to see, I may be wrong, but as I say, at this point, when everyone realizes that the starting gun for the elections has now been fired, I would be very surprised if MPs spend their time challenging the decree. I think they're all very busy now trying to figure out how they organize themselves for the elections.
How are you going to deal with the spoilers of this decree or the election process?
Our job is to try and ensure that the electoral model is conducted in a safe environment, which means providing security through AMISOM and through supporting national security forces, including in Puntland, where AMISOM is not present. And that's going to be a very big operation. And anyone who tries to spoil the elections through creating insecurity, we're going to try and deal with. Our job is also to support a free and fair process, which is going to be very tough, but that means helping Somali authorities put in place bodies that can monitor the preparations, that can observe the elections.
That's UN envoy to Somalia Michael Keaton speaking with Abdulaziz Osman of VOA Somali Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America, and today is Monday, May 23rd. I'm James Butte in Washington, and Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. The leader of a coalition of nearly 118 civil society groups in Burundi says nothing positive will come out of the current peace talks going on in the Tanzanian city of Arusha as long as key stakeholders are excluded. The talks are being facilitated by the East African Community. Not also invited to the Arusha talks is the National Council for the Restoration of the Arusha Accord, also known as SENARE. Burundi's Foreign Minister, Alain Nyamitwe, has in the past accused SENARE of involvement in violence. The group has denied such label, accusing the government instead of being the perpetrator of violence. Vital Nshimirimana of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society says the current talks are a monologue because President Pierre Nkurunziza only wants to talk to those who do not oppose him.
I was not invited, and this is one of the questions that my group is asking, the facilitator and the mediation, because the movement had a troisième mandat, which means stop to the third term of Pierre Nkurunziza, is the one which mobilized for the struggle for the respect of the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement, which called people for mass protest started in April 2015.
Now, the opposition scenario is also not invited. Why do you suppose the opposition is not there?
Well, Nkurunziza has initiated internal dialogue, which we call a monologue, because he's talking alone. He's speaking to people who cannot challenge him. And internally, they are proposing for the amendment of the Constitution to repeal the core provisions of the Arusha Peace Agreement. Now, it is like he has exported the internal dialogue to Arusha. Now, he wants to talk only with the people of his choice, and he's doing so with the facilitation of the newly appointed Secretary General of the East African Community, Mr. Liberatu Mukeko.
Of course, you know that an organization like Senare, the Burundian government has called that organization and other people terrorists who are trying to use violent means to overthrow the government.
Yeah, this is a narrative attempting to escape the reality on the ground. All the people, the international community, all human rights observers, medias can testify that the security forces are committing crimes against humanity, some acts of genocide. All these things are not committed by the opposition or civil society activists in exile. We have fled just because we were threatened. Our families were threatened.
What do you suppose will come out of the meeting in Arusha?
What can they expect when the opposition is not on the board? What do they expect when armed groups are not on the board? What do they expect when civil society are not on the board?
Vital Nshimirimana is the president of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society in Burundi. He was speaking with me from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Nigeria's Boko Haram militants continue to try to recruit in neighboring Cameroon, but Cameroon's government and international NGOs have started giving livestock to vulnerable youth to help them earn a living and prevent them from joining the terrorist group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from North Cameroon.
29-year-old Yegye Issa says he has not seen his only brother for a year since they were contacted by visitors to their village and offered $500 per month to join Boko Haram. Issa did not accept the offer and now takes care of his poultry farm in Cameroon's Zamai village, near the northern town of Mokolo. He got started with the help of chickens provided by the government and farming advice from United Nations staff. Issa says he can now provide for his wife, three children, and 72-year-old mother.
C'est que maintenant là, je vois que j'ai un pas dans l'avenir. Avant, quelqu'un était pauvre.
He says he is financially and physically more stable and can say without fear that the future is bright. He says he now has 60 chicks from the 9 chickens he was given, and his peers no longer insult him because he is incapable of taking care of his family. Issa is one of several hundred people who have benefited from the United Nations initiative to steer youth away from Boko Haram, which has frequently attacked northern Cameroon for the past 3 years. The coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon, Najat Rushdie, says the goal of the initiative is help the area's economy grow despite the continued violence.
Because the region was tragically and dramatically impacted by the insecurity on the one hand and the extreme violence by the other hand, it was very important actually to try to create a new dynamic, which is more of a positive dynamic, and more importantly, to provide the enabling environment for the revival of the local economy, capitalizing on the know-how of the people in the region.
Cameroon has provided $4 million in emergency funds to create jobs for youth on its northern border with Nigeria, where the unemployment rate is over 90%. Ibrahim Hamau, traditional ruler of Zamai, says the assistance has reduced delinquency among the 30,000 people he leads. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Zamai, Northern Cameroon.
The world's first humanitarian summit opens today in the Turkish capital, Istanbul. Participants will debate how to deal with global crises that have been exacerbated by war, climate change, and natural disasters. VOA's Nuraya Tesson reports from Istanbul.
According to UN figures, 125 million people need humanitarian assistance. More than 60 million have been forced to flee their homes due to conflict and violence, and 218 million have been affected by disasters each year over the past two decades. The international community has struggled to cope with the growing numbers. It's this crisis which has brought world leaders, politicians and NGOs to Istanbul on Monday and Tuesday for the World Humanitarian Summit. The Turkish city, itself a melting pot, is ready for the United Nations-backed conference. Over the next 2 days, the international community is expected to find ways to end what organizers describe as the greatest humanitarian crisis since the Second World War. The summit aims to address five main commitments, what the organizers call co-responsibilities: preventing and ending conflicts, respecting the rules of war, leaving no one behind on the sustainable development agenda, working differently to end need, and investing in humanity. Stephen O'Brien, Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, believes that this conference will be successful.
You've got a tremendous response with nearly 6,000 people here representing all the stakeholders, all the interested parties for humanitarian action. We've got 177 member states represented and 65 at heads of state, heads of government level. We've got world leaders from every other walk of life who are going to be here. That generates the will that will propel forward the ability to deliver the commitments to action, which is going to be the transformative opportunity we have to reach the scale of humanitarian needs, but also at the same time to be much better at preparing and mitigating the risks so that we can bring down the demand if we possibly can.
But not everybody is optimistic. Doctors Without Borders has announced that it will not be at the summit. The NGO, one of the world's most high-profile organizations, say that it does not believe that the conference will address the weakness in humanitarian action and emergency response, particularly in conflict areas or epidemic situations. About 80 of the UN's 193 member states have confirmed their attendance, with at least 50 of them being represented by their heads of state of government. For Voice of America News, I'm Nuria Tesson in Istanbul.
The World Health Organization has confirmed that the strain of Zika virus now circulating in the Americas and linked to brain abnormalities in babies is present in Cape Verde. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports this strain of the Zika virus, known as the Asian type, has been circulating in Cape Verde since October. It says it was most likely imported from Brazil, the epicenter of the epidemic in the Americas. Machidiso Moeti, the WHO Regional Director for Africa, says this is the first time this particular strain of the virus, which is linked to neurological disorders and microcephaly, a disease that causes brain damage in newborn babies, has been detected in Africa.
The findings are of concern because it's further proof that this strain is spreading beyond South America and is on the doorstep of Africa. This just emerged information will help African countries to reevaluate their level of risk and adapt and increase their level of preparedness.
Moeti assumed her current post in February 2015 at the height of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. She says she will build on the investments made in strengthening health systems in West Africa during the Ebola emergency to improve the region's readiness in dealing with Zika. She says surveillance will be increased, vector control measures taken, and the public informed of the need to protect itself from Zika by avoiding mosquito bites as well as sexual transmission of the virus. WHO's executive director, Bruce Aylward, says the agency does not advise a ban on trade and travel to Cape Verde.
The idea of travel restrictions, that fits in the bucket of seductively simple but stupid solutions. They don't work. And what you do is hugely complicate the ability to help a country that's already been hit by this thing to actually manage it.
A different strain of the Zika virus has been in parts of Africa for decades. Aylward says many people may have built up an immunity to the virus. He suggests one area of research is to see whether this immunity could mitigate the impact of the new strain. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa's Pulse. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with rugby. Scotland pipped South Africa 27-26 in the cup final, while Kenya outwitted Russia 31-7 in the Shield category final at the IRB 7 series in London, United Kingdom on Sunday. At the end of the 10-leg series for the season 2015-2016, South Africa runner-up behind Fiji and ahead of series defending champions New Zealand with 171 points. Kenya is 7th with 98 points and Zimbabwe 18th with 1 point. In football, hosts Ethiopia edged Ghana 2-1 in Addis Ababa. Zimbabwe and Cameroon drew 0-0 in Harare, as visitors Egypt pipped Rwanda 1-0 in Kigali in the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifiers on Sunday. On Saturday, defending champions Nigeria pipped Burundi 1-0. Angola overpowered Gabon 3-0. Senegal edged Tunisia 2-1. Namibia and South Africa drew 0-0. Burkina Faso and Republic of Congo drew 1-1, as did Mozambique and Lesotho. Gambia pipped Morocco 1-0 as Guinea edged Ivory Coast 2-1. Early on Friday, Mali outclassed Mauritania 3-0. In athletics, Almaz Ayana clocked 14 minutes and 16.31 seconds to triumph in women's 5,000 meters at the first IAAF Diamond League meet to be staged on African soil in the Moroccan capital Rabat on Sunday. What's more, Ayana ran the world's quickest time in the event this year. Conseslus Kipruto clocked a world-leading time of 8 minutes and 2.77 seconds to lead Jairus Kipchoge, Paul Kipsiele Koech and Lawrence Kipsang in a 1-2-3-4 Kenyan triumph in 3,000 meter steeplechase. South African Caster Semenya won women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 56.64 seconds, the world's quickest women's 800 meters this year. Burundi's Francine Nyonsaba was runner-up. Moroccan fans had something to cheer when Abdelati Igida won the 3,000 meters in 7 minutes and 36.85 seconds, the world's quickest time in the event this year. Timothy Cheruiyot clocked a lifetime best of 3 minutes and 33.26 seconds to lead Silas Kiplagat in a 1-2 Kenyan 1500-meter triumph. Ethiopian Diru Etenesh won women's 3,000-meter steeplechase in 9 minutes and 16.87 seconds. And the infield South African Rashwai Samai won men's long jump. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com. VOA News.